are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III, and my co-host does not speak German, but he can if you like.
Oh my God, I still really don't know how to say the name of that Lady Gaga song, and I won't even attempt it. Scheiße? Is that it? Anyway, I'm Louis Vertel. I'm back from my 9-day trip to Berlin, and I want to say that I took the time off just for vacation. But I think in actuality, I took it off so that Jay Jordan could handle the emotional burden of discussing Morgan Wallen. Thank you so much, Jay Jordan. Really a vacation for me. Wow, what a stupid pop culture subject that just occurred. And also, you know what? It wouldn't be fair for me to talk about that because I myself was out of God's country during that entire time.
There's no God in Berlin.
No, oh, let me tell you, I investigated and he is nowhere to be found, or she.
And while you were gone, Val Kilmer passed away.
That also was not good pop culture news. Val Kilmer, I first experienced in the movie Real Genius. I think people underestimate his comic abilities. But it's interesting because once upon a time, Val Kilmer's definitive project would have been when he played Jim Morrison. And now I feel like that's less the case because the name Jim Morrison has fallen out of sort of monocultural omnipresence. Like, do children know who the Doors are anymore? I do have to say I'm a bit concerned. I do think, meanwhile, that the movie Heat has picked up over the years, and that now is maybe his definitive movie, aside from the Batman stuff.
I feel like people know the Doors only in the context of reading Joan Didion.
Yes, which, you know, they still do, and she's still perturbed about kids doing drugs in 1969, which she should. Why are the babies doing LSD?
Well, she's dead, child.
Right. You know, she's sitting like in a in a cardigan, in the casket, you know, still like leaning up. But a very versatile actor. When you hear all these other, his co-stars talk about him, it's clear that it was very apparent to them he was, you know, an unstoppable force on the silver screen.
Yeah, I feel like I got introduced to him in Batman Forever.
That was the first time I saw him in the theater, for sure.
Yeah. So I'd probably seen like clips of Top Gun or Real Genius on TV, but it was Batman Forever that really introduced me to him. And of course, he's in that movie with Nicole Kidman.
Yes. Which is not as juicy a role for her as you would think, especially since during that time, she's doing really interesting stuff. That's when she's getting into the to die 4 years, etc.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny because I remember interviewing her and I asked her about Batman Forever. And she was like, it wasn't just for a check, you know, it was because like I enjoyed those movies. Like, I get to kiss Batman, you know, that was the pull quote from it. And now I wouldn't be shocked if she did a Batman movie because she just does anything.
No. What did she do with Aquaman? Like, teach him to fly? I don't know what Aquaman does. She's like Ang Lee in that she's kind of inspired by everything.
It's time for the intervention.
Yeah, no kidding.
I saw Holland.
Oh my God. Which, by the way, Nicole Kidman, you've already done 8 projects where everything seems so perfect from the outside, but could it really be? Nobody thinks everything looks perfect from the outside. What is this framework on these like Big Little Lies like show that does not exist? Everybody is suspicious of everybody else all the time. That's what makes life a good time. It's why we are into The White Lotus.
Yeah. Maybe we need the reverse of that finally. Actually, everything is perfect on the inside.
That's what I want. Yes. Like, this suburb seems very eerie. And actually, you know, they go to church a little bit often, but that's it, you know?
I really love this old 1996 article about Val Kilmer, by the way, in Entertainment Weekly, because it was titled "The Man Hollywood Loves to Hate." He described him as a difficult person to work with, which, by the way, what a fun cover story to have back in the 90s. Like, back when cover stories were interesting, it's just Entertainment Weekly. It's everybody hates you. Let's talk about it.
And there's like an X Factor quality about it. It wasn't like a death knell, you know, type situation. Even though in the years since, you know, he eventually played Mark Twain, right?
Yeah.
He got into some more interesting facets of his performing hood ultimately. But I mean, you and I, of course, lionized the era of that Entertainment Weekly, of Movie Line magazine, where you would open it up. And truly, this is just a 90s thing. Snark was king. You know, like all the comedies from that time, which are maybe dated now, all of them have kind of snarky, bastardly humor. I thought about this when I was watching The Opposite of Sex recently. It was unusually nasty, you know, but that was de rigueur, you know, like the cleanest comedy might have been something like, you know, Whose Line Is It Anyway? You know, but everything else had like a kind of bastardly stand-up male comic effect to it.
What's funny, too, is he's called Chronically Eccentric by Robert Downey Jr.
Chronically Eccentric. That's like something you say about, you know, Crispin Glover.
Yeah, you know, wiping his strand of hair away.
Yeah, it's something you say about somebody who is sweating for no reason.
I, of course, also loved the documentary Val from 2021, where he had just been filming himself for years, apparently.
Right, yes. And then he, of course, appeared in Top Gun Maverick, too, in a, I'm going to call it a strange performance. When I was watching that, I kept thinking of, like, who navigated what to put him in this place in the movie? And then he passes away in the movie, and it's like, I would say it's the most uncomfortable portion of the film.
Yeah, not the ending when they're on that bike and you hear Hold My Hand.
Oh, yes. I forgot that Stephanie was a big part of that project, yes. And also Monica Barbaro. I forgot she was in that movie too until we were reacquainted with her via A Complete Unknown.
Yeah. Anyway, Val Kilmer, there were a lot of beautiful tributes to him from Tom Cruise, who's going to be making the very last movie ever, I feel like.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible, the trailer for that movie looks like the final movie ever, a friend of mine said. And I agree.
Yeah. And you know what? Maybe we'll go out on that note. At this point, maybe we'd be cutting our losses, ultimately.
Speaking of cutting our losses, we got to talk about the White Lotus finale this week.
I think we have a lot to uncover and a lot of dead reckoning to do, quoth Mission Impossible.
Also, we're going to talk about this new live comedy show from John Mulaney on Netflix.
I can only be thankful to a man who wants to reinvigorate the late night format. I read a headline recently about somebody saying that obviously late night comedy, which is, by the way, where I make my living, is headed the way of the dodo. And the person who said it was my own boss, Jimmy Kimmel. So we'll take what we can get here.
Maybe he means you'll be taken to a secret island and hunted like the dodo birds.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we're headed right to Mauritius is what he meant. Yeah, where we will thrive until the 1600s and then it's over.
We're also joined by the very delightful Marseille Martin this week, who was in G20, the new Viola Davis action movie. I'm sure you have all seen the poster on your morning commutes of her in a red dress holding a fucking semi-automatic.
Just like in my dreams. It's great when things like this turn into reality.
We will be right back with more Keep It. Keep It is brought to you by Manukora. Harvested from the Manuka tree in New Zealand, Manukora honey is rich, creamy, and contains powerful nutrients to support immunity and gut health. Now, this is sounding like a Cadbury egg, the ones the bunny used to leave around at Easter, but it's a lot better for you. It is 3 times more antioxidants and prebiotics than your average honey, and all you need is 1 heaping teaspoon each morning to get the most out of the amazing bioactives in Manuka honey. It's a honey with superpowers. Now, it's easier than ever to try Manukora honey. Head to manukora.com/keepit to save up to 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts with the starter kit, which comes with an MGO 850 plus a Manuka honey jar, 5 honey travel sticks, a wooden spoon, and a guidebook. That's manukora.com/keepit to save 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts. That is manukora.com/keepit. Now listen, I add this stuff into my morning routine all the time. First of all, I'm beehive, so you know I love honey. And it just really does taste better when you're mixing it into, I don't know, like your protein shake in the morning before you hit the gym. So get up in that hive. Season 3 of The White Lotus aired its big finale on Sunday. The episode was 90 minutes long, and about 20 of those were worth discussing. Now that everything has been revealed, we're going to get into the deaths, the standout performances, and all the discourse of where the show should go from here. Let's just say we weren't fans of this season of The White Lotus a couple weeks ago, and the girls were mad.
I guess. Well, here's the thing. I think people really want to defend this show in principle because it's the pacing of it is so, I don't know how else to put it, adult. Like, they want you to, like, stick around and use your intuition to put these storylines together, to predict things, to be mad at certain characters. You know, I think we compared it before to Mad Men. It's a show that specializes in giving you very specific characters and leading them into unexpected places that are ultimately very justified. So there's a lot of chance and potential for, you know, the show to be amazing.
And it's deliberate, too.
Yes.
The pace is deliberate. They always want to defend the fact that Mike White says, this is a deliberate pace. You know, he had a quote recently when people called the show too slow. He told people to stop being bossy bottoms and to get out of his bed because that's the pace he was setting. First of all, didn't know Mike White was a top.
Nor did I know he had contempt for bossy bottoms, who, by the way, sometimes get the show on the road. I just want to say, we're thankful for them around here.
The show is deliberately paced, and I feel like that was my anger with the responses to our commentary on the season so far. Because there were people who accused us of having TikTok-addled brains, which... fair.
Okay, that's you, bitch. I am never on TikTok. So guess again, motherfucker.
But we watch slow shit all of the time, okay? First of all, Lewis loves a movie where a woman is staring outside a car.
Ding. Girl, I'll put on Anne of the Thousand Days right now. That's 3 hours of Anne Boleyn scheming her way into, you know, still being beheaded.
But this is HBO, okay? It's like the slow pace of an HBO show that is a massively watched popular television show that is memed constantly online. That is just remedial watching something slow paced. Okay. You're not reading Dostoevsky here.
Yeah. Right. Also, it's like, again, like the pacing, et cetera, is why we're invested in this show. Like, why we want to talk about it. It is an interesting show. But to continue Mike White's quote, he said, I'm world building. If you don't want to go to bed with me, then get out of my bed. I'm edging you. Enjoy the edging. If you don't want to be edged, then get out of my bed. Funny thing about edging is fun. This show, slow, headed nowhere, not like edging. Edging culminates. And I think my big problem with this season ultimately is that he set the chessboard. He put the players out there and then didn't move them around the board. It was a very static season. Edging is such a generous way to discuss what he had actually done with the character. He was idling. I'm sorry. There are characters on this show who are having conversations in episode 6 they could have had in episode 2. And the show still would have had a slow, deliberate pace. You know, I can't believe Jason Isaacs, like, stuck in some, like, migraine commercial or something where he has to gulp and do nothing else for episodes at a time. I, like, felt bad for him acting on this show. I think to start with pluses, though, the three women storyline, which was Michelle Monaghan, Leslie Bibb, and Carrie Coon. We did get a nice moment of catharsis where Carrie Coon explained that she was just grateful to be at the table with these two women who she's experienced a lot of life with, that her life had meaning because of the time spent. But at the same time, when she says to Michelle Monaghan, I'm happy you have a great face, that's what you say to your friend you appreciate? Bitch, can we get a rewrite on that? What?
Wait, she tells Michelle, you have a beautiful face. And then she turns to Leslie Bibb and says, you have a beautiful life.
Right, which is, okay, that I feel like is intentionally funny and interesting. But also, Leslie, does she have really a beautiful life? I don't know. Interesting. And then that was like the note we left off on them, even though later they witness a shooting and run off from it.
Yes. I think that at a certain point, the enjoyment of this season of The White Lotus has largely come from the internet factory associated with it.
Yes.
Whether you're reading memes, whether you're, you know, in Hunter Harris's like comments on her Substack, which I love to be in. I think at this point, the show has crossed over into, at least for this season, and bits of last season too, the show has crossed over into you're enjoying it because you're enjoying talking about the show and making jokes about the show. The show itself isn't that entertaining.
Or provocative.
To be honest, or provocative. You know, I mean, it's funny to talk about the fact that all these people got on a boat and didn't give a fuck that there was a mass shooting on the island.
Right.
You know?
But just moved right along.
does that make sense for the story?
Another thing that bothered me about the scuttlebutt about this season is I've seen a lot of people somewhat defensively say they're not into the mystery of the show, that it's only about the character development and the interesting interactions, whatever. That to me is some bullshit. One, what we're really discussing when we discuss the show is the mystery, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And then two, the mystery is a culmination of all the interesting other things about the show. Like the mystery culminates all the entitlement and the privilege, and it answers poetically. It's saying that when you put all this like bubbling under kind of grossness, you know, whiteness, et cetera, something bad will happen. So to me, the murder is a clever Agatha Christie-like way of still discussing the central themes of the show. So for that to feel, you know, not as interesting is like a huge letdown on the show. And I think that's ultimately why I would say this season is like a 2-star out of 4, as opposed to seasons 1 and 2, which I'd put in the 3.5, maybe even 4 range. I mean, there are so many amazing characters. Every storyline on season 2 was amazing. I mean, like F. Murray Abraham, that was the worst storyline on that show. He was fabulous. Of course he would be nominated for an Emmy. Whereas this year, and I said it again, aside from Carrie Coon and maybe Sam Rockwell for a monologue that I have to say I am already forgetting, I don't know that I would nominate anybody on the show.
I would say, too, that I think where we reach a point, people forget that we used to have these points in TV shows where you get to, like, the second or third season slump. You know, you're just figuring things out, and then you have to mix it up again. I really think that this show, a lot of the characters did seem listless. They weren't really connected. We've talked about this before, where even the construct of sticking them all on that boat just felt so, well, here they are, because the show felt very claustrophobic this season. The characters barely interacted in some really fun and interesting ways that made sense, you know, as opposed to the other seasons where they all kept zigzagging and interconnecting. Like, even the shooting at the end seemed very happenstance with, oh, here these people are.
Yeah, right. Oh, Amy Lou Wood happens to be walking by, and now she's going to be shot too. That's another thing. The Amy Lou Wood, Walton Goggins storyline, actually, like several storylines this season, made me feel like I had missed an episode because I couldn't even figure out why they were supposed to be interesting. Walton Goggins is set on this path to meet this guy who you would have to be an idiot not to know was his father. And there was like no suspense there. We were sort of just meant to like kind of study that downtrodden, exhausted face and like hope for nuance, but there just was no story there. Anything involving Sritala, I thought was like super boring.
I will say the big surprise for me this season actually is that Patrick Schwarzenegger, I think he can act.
I think he was compelling too. I mean, I think to be fair, he got one of the best arcs too.
Yeah, he got the best arc, I think, in the season. That moment at the end where he's watching Walton Goggins, you know, get that embrace on the beach. That, I thought, was a beautiful, like, pained moment from him. What's funny is that, you know, like, it ends up not being, you know, like, they don't give a fuck. Like, the emotions are all on his side, but it's all about what he's perceiving. So I love that aspect of it. Regarding the three women, I want to feel like the commentary is on sort of white women friendships, to be honest, because this "I'm just happy to be at the table" crying thing felt very much like, why are you putting yourself through this relationship? You know?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And it's just, I'm just happy to be here. It's like, no, girl, get some friends who like you. I felt very much in that scene, and I don't feel like people were reading this online, but I feel like these women are never talking to each other ever again.
Yeah, right. And also, that's specifically a storyline that I think could have benefited from interacting with the other characters more. Like, they had the thing with Valentine, like the sleeping around. But Carrie Coon sleeping with that guy last episode, you're telling me we couldn't have gotten to that way sooner? It just wasn't an interesting development for her. What this season needed way more of was, I think, the best scene on the entire show, which is in season 1, when Connie Britton confronts Alexandra Daddario, and they're having that conversation about that puff piece she wrote. And it starts as this docile, you know, vacation-paced conversation, and then turns into her reading her to filth. And like the both of them, and then Alexandra Daddario leaving really puzzled. Things like that I really wanted, which were, because that scene is both, one, believable. I could see that Connie Britton character doing that. And two, surprising, which is, again, the nexus of surprising and believable is where I think Mike White thrives the best. And I just didn't get that kind of X, Y factor.
If anything, I feel like there were so many interviews about how they were cutting scenes from the season because there wasn't time, et cetera, or whatever, which is comical because there was so much time this season.
All they had was time this last episode.
All they had was time. But the three women, I really felt like that was who Mike White gave a fuck about.
Yeah.
You know? And it was almost like he needed to create a series about the three dynamic women again interacting with each other. Like, he maybe missed that from Enlightened and, like, writing about Tanya, et cetera. And that's what the show was craving. I felt like there were interesting stories between, like, that and, like, the two brothers, right? You know, that were very shoehorned into a season of White Lotus when maybe they would have been better if he'd, like, written a play about any of those characters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, speaking of the Patrick Schwarzenegger family, first of all, the daughter's storyline is exactly what was wrong with this season. We spent 7 episodes listening to this girl being like, I need to move to Thailand for reasons you don't understand and I don't understand and the family doesn't understand, but we're going to keep pretending there are stakes behind this and that it would matter that she would upset Parker Posey, who was upset anyway. And then she makes the decision that she's like too princess-like to ultimately go through with it. That was a bit of a satisfying moment with her and Parker Posey, and Parker Posey feeling like satisfied to know her own daughter and what's good for her. But ultimately, like, then we get to Lachlan almost being poisoned. And of course, we knew that was coming. They had the poison berries in the fucking blender. We know those two things are going together no matter what.
Chekhov's blender.
If you will. going off in the third. Getting off in the second with his brother. Anyway. Then Lachlan justifies his weird behavior in the jacking off his brother during that one sex scene by saying, I just want to please people. Bitch, you were like lingering over his naked body in the first episode. What? That has nothing to do with pleasing people.
Yeah. I like the bait and switch with the younger brother sort of jerking him off and then him being, you know, stunned by it and having sort of this revelation. But what is this whole thing then with him being like creepily sexual with his brother and sister early on in the season?
Yeah, no, it just was ultimately a question mark. And of course, we have to talk about Belinda, another person who had nothing to do the whole fucking season. You're telling me her entire season was about one conversation with a guy we knew that would be happening with. It could have easily happened in episode 4 where this creepy guy, Tanya's ex, pays her the $5 million. And then we're just supposed to believe, like in a John Grisham thriller, everything is going to go well for her and she's just going to fly to Fiji and live or whatever. Like, she wrote the Pelican Brief and she's gone now.
And then he's just going to have a bacchanal at his pool because he really wants to give his girl a threesome.
Yeah, it just wasn't interesting. I don't know. I mean, like, maybe when her son Zion was trying to do the negotiating on her behalf and then she revealed that she was a bit smarter than he had expected, like, Zion maybe revealing himself as sort of a secret villain of this season is sort of interesting. But at the same time, not really. I expected way more from that.
By the way, Zion was giving, I got a black skin friend look like Michael Jackson. And it sounded like him too. His energy was this like dumb bro in the final episode. It was very disconcerting.
Attractive man.
Yeah. I do want to say, by the way, I don't give a fuck that Belinda left the island. It didn't have the same feel that it did of Tanya screwing her over.
Right. Because it's not a one-to-one comparison either. Like, she was always kind of dubious about Porn Chai.
So he got sex.
Yeah.
You know, she put it down for him.
Yeah.
He got something.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Lastly, I want to say, I just discovered that Sam Nivola, the twink, was Emily Mortimer's son.
Bitch, I was on this from day one.
And Alessandro Nivola.
The great Alessandro Nivola, who was just awesome in The Brutalist.
Yes.
But is in every fucking thing. I love Emily Mortimer.
And Kraven the Hunter, where he plays the rhino.
Yes. Emily Mortimer was also on Doll and M, an adorable show with Dolly Wells, one of my favorite underrated actresses.
Did you see the Vanity Fair interview where Vanity Fair or Variety, one of the V's.
Sure.
V for magazine. where Sam asked the cast to guess which actor inspired him to become an actor, and it wasn't his parents.
No, and whoever plays his sister on the show jumped up and goes, Juliette Binoche. I was like, all right, Sam Nivola, come on, keep it.
I'm peeping your game.
Yeah, I saw what you did. Also, name the Juliette Binoche projects. Is it more a Damaged thing? Is it the Red, White, and Blue movies? I want to know.
Also, I feel like Parker Posey or someone recently. There was an actress recently, I'm forgetting who named the Juliette Binoche films, The Red, White, and Blues, The Kieslowskis, as part of their Letterboxd four.
Ooh, I'm sure Parker Posey has a good answer to that question, so I wouldn't be surprised if it were her. By the way, can I just say, when people are not prepared for the Letterboxd four questions.
Come on. They're like stalking you at this point. They're like the Manson murders.
No,
okay?
They're at every fucking red carpet. And you, this is why you have a publicist, to be like, here, I'm going to push a DVD copy of Wanda in front of you. You can name drop this if you need to.
Anyway, to wrap up, I called the show Passions before, and I did get some comedy out of the blender, the poison blender. It reminded me of someone eating poison guacamole on Passions once before. But that really was just a lot of goofiness that I feel like is designed for people to laugh about and make fun of online, which there's not a problem with that. But when the memes are funnier and more interesting, you know, what are we doing?
Because Mike White is funny.
He is funny as hell.
And by the way, Parker Posey got way too broad this season. I was sort of dubious people celebrating her dialogue when she says Taiwan instead of Thailand. It's like, oh, so she's an idiot. It's like a bridge too far. And also, you just brought up the Jason Isaac storyline. I think the note it ended on was particularly bad, where it's just, actually, things are going to be all right for this family. Who decided on that? No, it's not.
Well, I think it's going to be abysmal.
Yeah.
But I did love the tweet coming back to life with a whole rent.
Yes.
Sort of like, I saw a bright light, and then I saw Angel. And he said, turn around and listen to that boy's song.
Yeah. Like
and then his eyes just wake up and his dad's there.
Yeah, right. Perestroika shit. Yeah, what is going on?
Also, last comment. People are so obsessed with being a part of the conversation on the show. I'm not expecting we're hiding spoilers and things, but I'm like, I saw someone put on their Instagram like story, just like a screenshot of him drowning in
Come
the pool. And I was like, who the fuck does this serve? We all know you're watching it.
Well, it's like the same people who have to yell congratulations at the drag queen who wins Drag Race milliseconds after it occurred. It's like, actually, they're not waiting to hear from you. So you can actually just not do that.
All right. Well, we're back. We are joined by the delightful Marseille Martin. But before that, some quick housekeeping. Crooked's newest series, Shadow Kingdom, God's Banker, is your next obsession. It all starts with a tip to journalist Niccolo Minoni from an old friend, one that pulls him deep into the story of Vatican banker Roberto Calvi, who was found hanging under a London bridge in 1982. Officials called it suicide, but Niccolo isn't so sure. Was Calvi laundering mafia money through the Vatican Bank? From there, things escalate quickly. An Italian warehouse raid uncovers a far-right society plotting a coup, toppling Italy's government and forcing Calvi into a corner. Just as he turns to the Vatican for protection, an assassination attempt on the Pope shakes the church to its core. What happens next? Listen to Shadow Kingdom, God's Banker now, wherever you get your podcasts, or binge all episodes now at crooked.com/friends or on the Shadow Kingdom Apple Podcasts feed. All right, when we're back, we're joined by the fabulous Marseille Martin. Keep It is brought to you by OneSkin. And no, I'm not talking about we're all one, we are the people. I'm talking about turning back time is simple with a little bit of movie magic, because when it comes to real life, getting our skin and hair to rewind 20 years isn't so easy. Plenty of products promise holy grail results, but with OneSkin, the proof is in the peptide. Yes, I'm talking about making your body look good. That's what OneSkin is. Specifically, the OS1 peptide, OneSkin's proprietary ingredient that targets zombie cells, aka cells that speed up aging at the cellular level. You can only find OS1 in OneSkin's moisturizers, sunscreens, and now in their latest product, OS1 Hair. This daily scalp serum tackles those same zombie cells in your hair follicles to reactivate your natural growth cycle. Now, if you know me, you know I'm all about my hair follicles. Lewis isn't here, but he does need to use it, you know, and he loves using it. You can ask him. You don't have to take my word for it. So if you're dealing with hair loss, thinning or shedding, or if you just want thicker, denser hair, try OS One Hair or any of OneSkin's products with 15% off your first purchase. Use code KEEPIT at oneskin.co. I really do love OneSkin because it keeps the skin glowing. And listen, these zombie cells that affect your face, white listeners, you might want to worry about those a little bit more than me. So hit up OneSkin and you can be glowing too. Founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists, OneSkin is redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS1 peptide. Get 15% off with code KEEPIT at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code KEEPIT. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our damn show and tell them we sent you. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin and scalp with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you.
I'm Nate Silver.
I'm Galen Druk.
And I'm Claire Malone.
We're back, this time with our friends at Crooked Media for a new show called
Still Counting.
Yeah.
Numbers are hard, takes are easy.
And frankly, numbers have only gotten harder.
What does the data actually say? How do we reconcile that with the other things that we're seeing in American politics and around the world? And how do we use that data to understand or maybe even dare to predict the future of American politics?
New episodes every Wednesday starting September 9th. Subscribe to Still Counting on youtube.com/@stillcountingpodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week, we are joined by a true mogul. You know her as an actress from projects like Blackish and Little, but she's just as involved behind the camera. She executive produced the Disney Plus series Saturdays, and when she was just 14 years old, she became the youngest ever executive producer for her work on Little. Today, she's here to talk about her latest film, G20, which drops tomorrow on Prime Video. Please welcome to Keep It, it's Marseille Martin.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
This movie is the kind of thing Ira and I like dream will exist. Like, we just want Viola Davis to be like kicking ass and centrally in the movie. She's obviously been in action movies before, like Black Hat and Woman King, Widows, etc. But here, I mean, she's at the height of her powers, I will say. Talk about working with her, first of all. And just, she's the kind of person I feel like I would just be picking up crazy details about how she operates in every single sector of a movie.
Yeah, no, she is amazing. And I mean, I always saw her, like, ever since I was little, through different events or even mutual friends. But to now have worked with her in this high, intense project was insane and amazing. And, you know, I was fully convinced that she was gonna be like a butthole in my head, because it's like, when you're a legend like that and you have all these accolades and, you know, you got a whole bunch of stuff under your belt, you ain't gotta be nice. So in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm prepared. But no, it was like literally the complete opposite. She is so kind and so down to earth. And how I get my advice is normally being very observant. I will never ask anybody, like, please give me like tips, tricks or whatever, because most of the time I probably low-key like won't remember or make sure like I'm really locked in to make sure I understand what you're saying. But watching her craft and watching how she perfects it and the little techniques that she does to get prepared for a scene and all the training that it takes to do things like this and the team that she constantly has around, like we had the same team that she had in The Woman King. And so she pretty much had that same preparation for that project just as much as, you know, what she had for G20. So seeing that whole process was incredible and very surreal and just inspiring. Yeah.
I need to know the process behind either rehearsing, filming this big set piece in the film where you two are in a helicopter.
Yeah.
And so what was it like filming that?
That helicopter scene was a lot. It took a week to shoot, and it was the last week of filming the entire project. So reading the script, that was the one I was most nervous about because I didn't know how they were going to do it, how they were going to film it, if it's going to look weird or corny or tacky or like whatever that looks like, because I've never seen it myself. And then being with, you know, Miss Viola and Anthony, who is also great at being very psycho and a villain, it was like, how am I put in this like crazy triangle? It's insane. So I couldn't believe that I was even a part of something like that. But yeah, from day one all the way to, I mean, weeks later and then having the strike and then coming back, I was still thinking about that one scene and seeing how it was going to happen. And it was fun. It was exciting and it was a lot and challenging. But when you look at it, it was very worth it. All the ADR, all the things that came into it, all the preparation and stunt work that we had to do, and all the safety meetings that we had to have for it, it made sense at the end.
Now, of course, Anthony Anderson is in this movie. You worked on Black-ish for many, many years. I have a question. Do you mm-hmm. prefer to leave people on past projects behind so that when you go to a new thing, it can just be your new experience and there's nobody there with the expectations of what you were or are? Or do you like having people you've worked with previously on newer projects?
That's hilarious because I toss back and forth with it. I think as an actor, you always want to have that like new experience. But at the same time, I wanted to have a person that was like my The Rock to my Kevin Hart, like just kind of doing every damn thing and just seeing what that looks like. But I don't know. I loved it with Anthony, though, because it felt so new to me jumping into it. I mean, we were in Africa. That was my first time in Africa. New terrain, new space, new directors, and working with material that just felt so new that it doesn't matter how much preparation that I had to do with it, I was still going to feel somewhat unprepared because it was all new. But having Anthony there to have some type of familiarity on set and for us to go band for band on different scenes and going back and forth and to know like his techniques and for him to know mine, it felt comfortable and I felt completely safe. And that was fun to do for sure. Actors are actors. So I think there's a few, like a handful of people that I would definitely go back and forth on movies with, like Regina Hall. I would gladly do a movie with her again. I mean, Viola Davis, of course. So, I mean, there's some people that's just like an immediate yes to whatever project you're a part of.
Now, speaking of people that you've been on projects with before too, you know, there's Little, where you starred in with Issa Rae. And it's so funny thinking about, there was one of her first big movies too, you know, and you're both coming from the sitcom world, but she was like this HBO Insecure and you're coming from Black-ish. And you'd been on it weirdly, you know, even being younger than her, a couple, like 2-3 years before she was even doing Insecure, you know? So
yeah.
What was that like coming to set, both of you working together? I guess you were like the veteran at that point.
I mean, yeah, it's funny because me and my family, we say I'm a veteran in this a lot of the time. But no, I mean, it was great because I already loved Issa and the work that she's done and knew the things that were coming up for her and just how she is so grounded with where she came from and having that pretty much be the core of all of the things that she has, I mean, coming to fruition. And I mean, she's truly an inspiration to me in that regard too. Like now with her having a restaurant and her beverage line and so many other things, I mean, the record label, it all fits. And that's what I love. And I think more creators should branch off from traditional TV and film and just kind of create where they want to. I mean, there's no boundaries in this. And when a lot of people say breaking boundaries and changing narratives and all that, they normally think like in TV and film, like this is a traditional way of doing it. But there's so many different lanes of different business ventures and entrepreneurial ventures that have not been tapped into, especially with Black women. So, I mean, she's truly an inspiration in that regard. And yeah, I continue to do the same things in within my core stuff and then jumping into different lanes as well.
We mentioned earlier that you are the youngest ever executive producer on a movie on Little. I want to be clear, you're like 20 years old now. Little is now mm-hmm. like a number of years old. So like do the math, everybody.
Yeah.
Did you anticipate that kind of milestone for yourself? Like, are you shocked to find yourself the youngest ever producer, or was that always sort of in your playbook from the beginning?
No, definitely not. I mean, none of this was in my playbook. I mean, let's be real. Probably like my family knew, because, you know, like, you know, in Black families, they'd be like, oh, I knew she was going to be all that. Like, you know, they'd be hyping up the baby at 8 months. But yeah, it was kind of like that. But for me, I was just having fun. I mean, I started acting as a hobby, like things that I would do after school back in Texas. And that's pretty much how I take most things on, is having fun with it first. You know, if it's not fun for me, or if I don't have passion behind it, then I'm just not going to do it, you know? And that's just always what it's been. And I mean, the accolades are great. The title and the world records are very, very nice. And I'm beyond grateful, because I know that's God's plan. But for me, I feel like I'm putting myself at a limit if I decide, like, oh, this is the reason why I'm doing this, or this is, I want this, so I'm gonna get this. Because, I mean, no one knows what God's plan is gonna be. So I don't wanna put myself at a disadvantage trying to do something for something that I don't know if it's gonna happen or not, you know? So that was exactly what Little was. Like, I just wanted to create a story that hasn't been seen in this light, especially from a Black woman perspective. And that's just kind of the things that came with it.
I have to imagine, you know, being this young mogul, being this producer at this age, and then still working in other projects with people your own age who maybe aren't doing that. You know, do you find yourself being asked for, I guess, business advice by people who are sort of your own age? Or do you find yourself, you like doling that out?
Yeah, all the time. A lot of people ask me about it. And it's kind of funny for me, because I'm still trying to learn my own dang self. So for me, I'm like, I don't know. I'm just out here. So you do you, boo. But yeah, a lot of the time I'll go talk at schools, or even just see somebody on the street that will ask either me or moms, asking my mom about advice, and even my dad. So it's a lot for all of us as a family. But I mean, as long as we know who we are to our core and know what we stand for, it's kind of just like, you know, it's God's plan for everything, and what's for you is what's for you, and you just go from there.
Now, Black-ish obviously ran a number of years. You know, as it progresses, I assume when you build that kind of family unit, a lot of things become easier. But I was wondering, after a while, is there anything shooting a show like that after a while that actually becomes more difficult? That you, like, unforeseen challenges that come up from, you know, doing the same project year in and year out?
Yeah. I think probably the challenges that I had to tackle the most, I can probably think of two. One of them was definitely not getting stuck in that character. I think oftentimes when you play a character for many, many years and then you jump into another project, it's really hard not to think of it as Diane, or like as this is just another, you know, quote unquote, sassy, witty, with glasses type of kid. And, you know, I mean, oftentimes, like in the industry, that's the reason why they want you, right? It's because they saw you as Diane, or they saw you do this. And then they're like, all right, now do that again, but for this. And that's kind of not what I really want to be on. But yeah, growing up, it was hard. It was definitely hard for me to kind of break the two. But I think with a lot more studying and kind of learning different tips and tricks that I had to kind of prepare myself to get ready for a certain project, like creating her backstory, or what makes this character different for than Diane, and why is this important for people to see and for people to understand, and what makes her and what makes her human. I think all of those are questions that I constantly ask myself with any character that I portray. So I think that was definitely one of the more tougher things that I had to learn, especially when I was little. And I think being on a show, you kind of get, I mean, in ABC, you are an ABC person. So jumping into different projects was always really hard, because I was always on set and I only had a hiatus for like probably 2 months. But do I want to work in those 2 months? Probably not. But that was the only time that I had to jump into other projects. So I had to really choose, like, okay, am I going to stress myself out by working all year long, or take this break and then just still keep doing the same show for many, many years. And that was a lot too. So those are the two challenges that I had to face growing up.
Mm. What kind of stuff do you find yourself returning to that you watch? You know, I mean, you work so much. Like, do you like watching sitcoms or the same kind of stuff you're on? Or do you have like completely different tastes that we might be shocked about?
I like Adult Swim. I normally put Adult Swim. Okay. I like the... like the Bob's Burgers and the Boondocks of the world. That's mm-hmm. my show. And then I like reality shows. I like Love is Blind. I like Million Dollar Secret. That was fun. I don't think a lot of people are talking about that, but that's new.
The new one on Netflix?
Yes, the new one on Netflix.
Yeah, Secret Millionaire. I am watching it.
Okay, what do you think?
I love it. I love it. I always get stuck on one of these like Netflix things. They had one like that last year too, where they had Money in a Box, The Trust or something.
I saw that, but I wasn't that interested in that. Yeah. This one, like I was like, okay, I'm interested.
So the concept of this show is that there's like 12 people, each of them go into this mansion and one of them finds out that they have $1 million in a box. And then they have to lie to everyone else, but then there are other clues to try and figure out who the millionaire is. I mm-hmm. like the twist that you're able to trade the money if you accomplish something into someone else's box, so you can basically get the heat off yourself. But I thought it was very dumb that woman revealed to everyone that she was the millionaire.
That
before.
Was so dumb. I get why, because like I mean. She was probably very emotional. She mm-hmm. probably thought she was kind of out of that whole situation and people were going to love her more for it and trying to like keep her in. But no, those people are ruthless. You lied for 3 days. But also at the same time, that's the goal of the show. Like,
right.
Why are you mad that she lied? That's the reason why she's here.
No, you watch The Traitors, of course, right? Where people get very emotional that somebody lied to them. It's like, there's literally no other way to play the game. You have to lie.
Maybe that's why you're on the show. You gotta lie to kick it. I'm sorry. But I really do love that show. Oh, well, I can't spoil it. But Sam, the most recent one, I think she's been the best millionaire so far. And I love the advantages that you have to like do and get and I love it. I feel like I would do good on that show or somebody in my family.
It's a good test of also just how you interact with people. That's what I love about reality shows, like seeing mm-hmm. how people act on them and how we pick up different personalities from people, because there are tasks on the show where you have to give everyone a hug. That's in the first episode, you know,
right.
to accomplish your goal. But then you think about when you're in an environment like that or even in the real world, it's, are you going to think that person's weird for hugging everybody? And things are just heightened.
When that guy left they kicked him out because he held their hands while he was praying and thought that was an advantage and was like, you're the millionaire, get out. It's like, no, you just pray when you hold everybody's hand. Like, that's just what we do. And I'm like, yeah, that's not... What? Yeah, it's cool. I love that show.
This has also been a really good advertisement for the show. I now have to watch this.
Yeah, okay.
Honestly.
It sounds like The Traitors, too, where they have like little physical challenges.
It is The Traitors, actually. But the rules make a little bit more sense than The Traitors.
Oh, good. That is the crucially dubious part of that game.
It's actually The Traitor, the liar, is at some points a little bit more disadvantaged than The Traitors are, where they have too much power, I think.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
And the money switches hands, too. If you get the millionaire, if you get like the person out, then the money switches to someone else next time. And so someone who is like a faithful, as you would think, could become like the traitor the next day.
Oh, I see.
Exactly. But it's the money doesn't really count until like towards the end. So that's why everyone is like, I don't want the money right now because it's going to move.
Right.
But I want it when it actually counts, when I'm close enough to being the winner and actually being the millionaire. So it's pretty fun.
Now, my last question, you already brought her up. Can you talk for a second about Regina Hall, who was on this podcast before?
Sweet.
In person, she is very normal. Like, she's like a chatty, down, cool person. And then, of course, I watch her on screen, and she is one of the scariest and most hilarious and weirdest fucking people you will ever see. What was your interaction with her like, and watching the difference between her performing and not performing?
It's funny because her humor-wise, I can't tell the difference. It's like, she always just catches me off guard. And I'm like, girl, wait, hold on. But I've known her for such a long time. She also worked on Black-ish as our babysitter when I probably had to be like 9, 10. So I've been around her for a minute to like understand like what it is with her. And she is so funny and so sweet. And that's also one of the actors that I love, kind of like what she has done within her career and the characters that she has chose to like portray and be a part of. Cause you have seen her scary, but you've also seen her like just super funny, but different layers of humor. There's sitcom humor and then there's like dark humor and, you know, like it's really hard to make somebody laugh, but she knows how to make somebody laugh in multiple different ways. So I just think she is so sweet and I would do millions of projects with her. And yeah, she's awesome.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Thank you guys so much.
God, what a pleasure. Yeah. Come back and hang. Well, I'll watch a reality show and then like debrief and like compare
and then
notes
debrief.
And stuff. Yeah.
This is its own show, guys. Yeah. We can definitely do
our recap podcast we have going on here. Yeah.
Yes. Agreed. Well, thank you guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Marseille, for joining us. And remember, G20 drops on Prime Video tomorrow. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. With Squarespace's collection of cutting-edge design tools, anyone can build a bespoke online presence that perfectly fits their brand or business, just like I did with iramadison.com, the most beautiful website Squarespace has ever powered. Start with a Blueprint AI, Squarespace's AI-enhanced website builder, to get a fully custom website in just a few steps. Using basic information about your industry goals and personality to generate premium quality content and personalized design recommendations. Squarespace also offers a complete library of professionally designed and award-winning website templates with options for every use and category. Squarespace also gives you everything you need to offer services and get paid, all in one place. From consultations to events and experiences, showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. Plus, streamline your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools. And when it's time to grow your brand, get discovered fast with integrated Squarespace SEO tools. Every website is optimized to be indexed with meta descriptions, an auto-generated sitemap, and more. So you show up more often on search engines and bring in more of your ideal customers. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/keepit to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/keepit.
I'm Nate Silver.
I'm Galen Druk.
And I'm Claire Malone.
We're back, this time with our friends at Crooked Media for a new show called
Still Counting.
Yeah.
Numbers are hard, takes are easy.
And frankly, numbers have only gotten harder.
What does the data actually say? How do we reconcile that with the other things that we're seeing in American politics and around the world? And how do we use that data to understand or maybe even dare to predict the future of American politics?
New episodes every Wednesday starting September 9th. Subscribe to Still Counting on youtube.com/@StillCountingPodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
For the past few weeks, John Mulaney has been trying things his own way with his new Netflix series, Everybody's Life with John Mulaney. Lewis and I have finally tuned in, so we're going to discuss whether Mulaney is adding anything to the comedy landscape or if he's missing the mark.
Fuck him. No, I'm kidding. It's good. the first thing I love about this show is he announces that it's at Sunset and Gower, which is such a nondescript location in LA. And in fact, it's where I like go and eat salad every night after the gym. So it's in the pit of LA, unpretentiously.
Didn't they used to shoot Nickelodeon or something there?
Yes. Several things have been there over the years. I want to say I was on a game show one time. No, that was Sunset in Las Palmas, but same stretch of just bland, like that part of Santa Monica Boulevard and Sunset is like storage spaces. So it's funny to have like a high octane TV series there. But also, I do love about this show that he assigns a topic to each episode. And in the most recent one, it was just squatters. So they have to sit there and just talk about squatters the entire time. I love that. I love that they just pick something and news peg it as opposed to having to talk about whatever's happening on the news every single day. Because somehow over the years, we've given everybody the idea that talk shows are here to kind of calm us away from how bad the news can be. And why? There's just no reason for that. It can get especially stale after a while. I say that as I just got done writing 10,000 Elon Musk jokes.
He's in space, right?
Yeah, right. He loves it up there. And we're going to do our best to keep him up there with his fellow cosmonaut, Katy Perry.
By the way, we will be talking about that next week. I'm just doing that as a brief aside. Like, the ladies are going to space. We're going to talk about it. There's been like one person in our YouTube comments every fucking week being like, when are you going to talk about them going to space? What the fuck do you want us to say? They're not there yet.
There they go. Yeah. We just look up, like in the movie Don't Look Up. We just do that.
Yeah. Obviously, it's fake feminism, like Katy's album. But there's nothing else to say yet.
Also, you know I enjoy the song Smile by Katy Perry. So sometimes if you want me to get in here and defend the worst of Katy Perry, just to let you know, I may do it. But back to the show. The last episode, he just started with this monologue talking about how he was supposed to book Bone Thugs and Harmony for this comedy bit they were doing and why they fell apart. And at first, it was like, I enjoyed that he was being just straightforward with the audience about something that was happening behind the scenes, you know, on a talk show like this. Then I was like, is this mean to Bone Thugs and Harmony? And then it ended with him realizing he may not have even been talking to the real manager of Bone Thugs and Harmony. And I have to, like, things like that, I found it entirely refreshing and strange and really unexpected from him, since he's a stand-up. And I expect it just to be kind of clippy jokes that are the same pace as, you know, Dave Letterman or Conan or Kimmel or whomever. And he really took his time, and it didn't feel like too much time. So I think that's an awesome way to handle a talk show.
I think that the talk show, too, feels in a way. Obviously, there's the 80s Hollywood aesthetic of it. I love the feel that it feels Los Angeles, but like the fun part of Los Angeles from the vintage movie era.
Yes.
You know, not the influencer era of Los Angeles. Like, you know, the kind that's in the movies.
Like American Gigolo or something, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. American Gigolo, or that sequel to X.
Oh, the Mia Goth one.
The Mia Goth series.
Yes, it's in the 80s, yes, right.
Yes, in the 80s. It feels a lot like a show that would be a talk show on a sitcom or comedy.
Uh-huh.
You know, it feels like we'd only see funny clips of him being like, we're going to talk about funeral planning this week, you know, or we're going to talk about cruises, but you actually do get the conversations, which I find interesting. You know, I feel like they're interesting things that you would hear on a comedy podcast more so than you would hear on a talk show. And it's bringing back that weird, fun element of what a talk show can be. I love the cruise episode.
Oh, yeah, me too. Also, I just love, like, if you watch old episodes of Dick Cavett, or, I mean, a number of talk shows like this, but specifically that comes to mind, he'd have, like, Janis Joplin on, talk with her for, you know, 30 minutes, be like, you have about 10 minutes left to live, Janis. And then the next guest would just come on and sit and talk with them all, and it was like Gloria Swanson, like people that have nothing to do with each other.
That's what I love.
Yeah, something specific about this show is nobody is cast just because they have a project coming out. In fact, none of these people had something like that coming out. Like, John Waters was there with Wanda Sykes. Great. Let's put them together and talk.
Joan Baez,
who was great on the show and was like, did a stirring call to action, as Joan Baez would. Honestly, if I had to change one thing, I would get rid of the audience, because the show is so weird on purpose that kind of listening to a conventional talk show audience respond to the comedy beats makes it feel a little strange to me. And I just think, like, having a silence after something completely droll and strange occurs is a little bit funnier.
I think that you and I have definitely talked about this before with talk shows. The missing element of all of the guests of that episode being on the couch together is what I definitely miss from talk shows.
Yeah.
And it seems to have gone away, I guess, with the scheduling of shooting. And also, I feel like publicists are probably behind that too. You don't want your client sitting here with some other random person, you know,
because
they could just say anything.
Especially if they're there to promote a project. Like, does that mean like they get less time to talk about the thing that they're there to talk about? You know, obviously somebody we love who handles this really well is Graham Norton. But there's just something about the UK and talking that is so much more advanced. Like, they just will allow themselves to sit and sort of stretch out, and like they can count on the natural wit of each other to make the conversation appealing. And we just cannot do that over here.
They go to have fun on Graham Norton too. You know, I mean, I think you know this from working on a talk show, and we know this from, I mean, interviewing people. This is a talk show.
Yeah. Oh yeah, sure.
You really just cannot get past the whole, this person's here to promote something, so you have to talk about it, you know?
Right, right. And it's weird because it's like, you don't want to, like, the people who book it, you don't want to, like, disappoint them. They book all sorts of other people, et cetera. And, like, obviously, like, you want the conversation to go well and be listenable, and you want to be a part of the business with all these people. But it is a little fraught that way when it's about promoting a project and you want to, you know, tap into the humanity of this person outside of just whatever they just made 10 minutes ago.
That's why you like, you know, the older talk show moments where it's, this person's been on this show, like, multiple times, you know, like friends of the family who just seem to, like, celebrities who come on all the time, they're just dropping by.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of that anymore. You know, recently on the Jimmy Fallon Tonight Show, I was always sort of intrigued by the fact that Fran Lebowitz would come on and be friends with them, because they do not seem like they're part of the same New York, really.
She's seen them at the bar.
Yeah, okay, perhaps. But, like, they had an interesting rapport there that was unexpected that took me back to, you know, the Amy Sedaris Dave Letterman or the Terry Gard David Letterman. Actually, you know who one of the best David Letterman guests of all time is? Julia Roberts.
Yes.
Every time she was on that show, she was like, woof, you won't believe who was an asshole to me the other day. Nick Nolte, you know?
That's another thing where the podcast is sort of taken away. For people, obviously, now people go on podcasts to promote things, but there are a lot of fun celebrity podcasts or even just comedians doing podcasts or like our early days of when we were doing this, right? And you just have friends stop by.
Yeah.
They're not promoting anything. They're just talking. And I think that that is what people miss about talk shows in general. It's what you miss in the industry that would create stars, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Because if everyone is just coming there to talk about their fucking project, people zone that out a lot, you know? They're like, okay, I'm either going to go see it or not. But what they remember is the personality. They remember Julia Roberts coming on and being angry about something. I think your show, Kimmel, still sort of has that element whenever Matt Damon comes on.
Yeah, and most talk shows have the benefit of being on for, like, years and years, too. So you can, like, harken back to old versions of the show, you know, change it as you will, but it's, like, still very dependable. But you're right, like, the meat of the conversations on these shows, I think, has the greatest potential to change and be more interesting. Even though, by the way, on this show, like, John Mulaney as a conversation proctor, he's pretty, like, while he's funny, he's not particularly speedy. Like, Graham Norton will, like, get you to a joke fast, like, throwing it down. Like, he makes it a little bit urgent. There's something about gayness that really lubricates that conversation. Whereas on his show, I'm sort of fascinated that he'll leave things a little bit awkward. I don't know if I like personally living in that space as a viewer, but I do think it makes it an interesting feel. You know, there's almost something kind of Nathan Fielder about how he approaches it.
Yes. Honestly, that would be a fun talk show.
Well, he is so frightening.
His version of a talk show, he is terrifying.
The haircut alone, first of all. And then secondly, how he operates. I mean, like, and you know he's, like, really cool and with it. Like, you know, Emma Stone's obsessed with him. She's, like, weirdly a person I really trust in this space. You know, if Emma Stone's producing your thing, I'm on board with you. But, yeah, like, he has that kind of creepy, what is on his mind energy, even as he sort of is staring you straight in the eye, kind of boring holes in you.
You know, what's, what I really enjoy about this, too, is it's like it says, it's promoted as a live Netflix comedy show, you know? And I think Jay was talking about this a lot last week, too, with just needing to stop giving bad Netflix specials to unfunny people and just sort of really just branch out into different avenues of comedy and build up a comedy repertoire for Netflix, you know? I feel like there used to be more funny things that I'd want to watch on Netflix, and now it's just sort of Secret Millionaire.
Right. By the way, you know what else could stand to be revamped? The idea of a comedy special. We've had a couple of things over the years, like Rathaniel or, you know, things that mix it up a little bit that have interstitials that are strange. But ultimately, like, nothing surprises me more. Growing up, I really thought stand-up would be the bread and butter of what I did. You know, like, I that would be the format in which I presented jokes, etc. And now, I just don't crave it as much.
I want to see your comedy special.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm just going to, like, take people to, like, a gallery of, like, golden age Hollywood stars and explain them to you. By the way, when I was in Berlin, I stayed in Marlene Dietrich-Plotz, brought that up to everybody I met.
Do they have a gorilla suit there?
Oh, that would, I wish I came out with like the top with the, you know, the Madonna top hat and like tails every time I went out. Yeah. That would have been sweet. Tyrone Power is my background on my phone. And of course, he was in his final movie with Marlena, Witness for the Prosecution, which I've talked about in every fucking YouTube video I've ever done for Crooked. So look it up.
Yeah. That gorilla scene, by the way, I mean, speaking of Batman, remember the Poison Ivy scene where Uma Thurman came out, you know, paying homage to the Marlena Dietrich scene.
Yes.
And then remember when Taraji Henson did that on Empire?
No, I did not see that. Excuse me?
That. Season 2 of Empire. Wow. Taking it really back, because the first season of that show was so good and then it dropped off so quickly. But season 2 of Empire starts with, of course, a Black Lives Matter protest, because the Black show had to do that.
Right. Putting me the exact moment in time. Here we are.
Taraji P. Henson in a gorilla costume, beating her chest, doing the Marlena Dietrich, revealing herself under it. Crazy.
Thank you, Empire. I can only be thankful for that.
Thank you, Lee Daniels.
Marlena Dietrich is a name that like people don't know anymore. So I'll take any sort of like renaissance we have, you know.
She's in the Vogue song though, right?
Yes. No, I would say if people know her through anything, it is the Vogue music video, which is mainly a tribute to old Marlena Dietrich photo shoots. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen her in Morocco, her nominated movie, really good. Mark Harris was talking about that recently. It's a really good movie from 1930, pre-code.
Speaking of pre-code, I just want to say quickly, we've gone on so many tangents here.
Yeah, sorry.
We're going to talk about it in a few weeks when we have our theater preview again and talk about what's out there. But I'm wearing a Betty Boop shirt. I saw Boop on Broadway.
So fucking
and
jealous.
And it is so fucking funny.
Oh, thank God.
The book is hilarious.
Betty Boop, bend that bitch. I don't know if people are unfamiliar. You watch the cartoons, you're cooking right there with her.
Yeah.
You follow her on the journey, which she always has.
And some of those were pre-code, so yeah. They're a little racy.
Right, right. I already talked about Nancy Comics recently, right?
Yes, you did talk about Nancy Comics.
I'm still on the Nancy tip. Nancy and Sluggo and I, we were vibing.
Nancy the Musical, coming soon.
Oh my God, she'll be pissed. It'll be like Mama Rose shit.
Anyway, John Mulaney, I really enjoy this show. I think that Netflix is doing something fun here by having a talk show that is just a little strange. It's a little weird. And I think that they should make more of those because they have the money for it.
Also, Richard Kind is on it. And they really just picked the strangest celebrity we have.
I missed him on TV.
Spin City was a good show. That was like one of the last like hard punchline multicams that I really enjoyed.
Yes. The whole Spin City news radio era of comedy is
working with Fred Savage. Loved that show.
Yeah, I forget that Richard Kind was obviously on Curb Your Enthusiasm for years.
Right.
But it felt like I haven't seen him on TV in forever.
No,
it's just
right.
Nice seeing him. All right, when we're back, keep it. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis.
Yes. Actually, Ira, you go first this week. I'm still back from Berlin. I'm disoriented. I'm sleeping like 10 and a half hours a night. Up is down. Make it easy on me.
Poppers aren't banned there.
No. Oh, they sure aren't. That became my favorite food.
My Keep It this week goes to Bravo and the Real Housewives of Atlanta.
Oh, it's a bad week for you when these people are doing you dirty, because this is your community, as we say.
Yeah. You know, we're a family, like a giant tree.
Yep. Okay.
We're the Dreamgirls.
Yeah. You're Shirley Ralphing this week. Why?
Well, I mean, this week was a nightmare, girl.
Okay. I'm there. Go ahead.
So this is the week that Kenya Moore, you know, icon of Bravo. She's been on Housewives for years. She left the series this week in a very traumatic episode for viewers if you're a fan of her. Backstory, this season, Britt Eady, a new housewife, joined the series. And she used to date Rick Ross. Now she's dating a light-skinned man who's kind to her and who lets her eat lobster tails for dinner and lunch. You know, it's a thing.
Okay.
She started a beef with Kenya this season over the fact that Kenya made a reference to a ring that she was wearing. Just because she's asking about her marriage, she's asking about her ring, she's commenting on her ring. It's maybe a light, shady joke. It's maybe a question. They keep flashing back to this as if this is the reason for a beef. But really, like, this woman just sort of was clearly going after Kenya this season to start a storyline.
Sure.
Anyway, they get into an argument over the course of the season. And last week, during their fight, when Kenya told her, I don't speak to peasants, etc., Britt says, maybe you shouldn't play with me because I got pistols.
Okay. Good reason not to mess with somebody, to be honest.
Good reason not to mess with somebody. The next week, Kenya responded, unfortunately, by using the launch of her hair spa to show photos of, I guess, a sex tape that Britt had made in the past.
Interesting promotional technique.
Yeah. Interesting to do it at the launch of your own new company, especially one that you've dedicated to your daughter. I was very mad at Kenya for doing this. I was very mad at Bravo for not sort of reprimanding and kicking Britt off in the first place for threatening someone with a gun. I think that there's just a lot of mess that's going on here, and the fandom is in turmoil.
And yeah, where do we go from here? I say this as somebody who will never, ever watch this show. Go ahead.
I mean, Kenya sort of ruined this herself. It was just disappointing to see her go out like that. I guess my keep it is mostly to her, because I feel like you've been in situations like this before. You knew that doing what could technically be considered revenge porn is going to get you kicked off the show, at least for the season.
Also, what do you mean technically revenge porn? It is revenge porn.
Yes. Well, I think that there's a legal thing that's going to be fought, you know, if it was widely available, is it revenge porn? If you just reprinted it.
Oh,
you
know? I see. Okay. Sometimes I'm reminded that I'm not a lawyer. You know, sometimes I don't know, or I forget, you know.
Well, I've got Patty Hughes on speed dial.
Oh, my God. Oh, speaking of Patty Hughes, Guy Branum, friend of Keep It, who's been on many times, was on regular Jeopardy as a contestant, and he got second place. He did nothing wrong. He was great. There was just a guy who beat him a couple times to the buzzer. But there was a question about damages. Namely, the answer was, who was Glenn Close? To watch Guy get beaten to the buzzer on that.
Ah!
More emotional than the entire White Lotus finale. It was so sad to see that.
By a gay?
No, I don't think so.
Wow.
He did get in on a Barbara Streisand question, at which point he actually winked at Ken. Good. That's what I want to see. Thank you.
You know, I'm glad he got a little wink in, because I've interacted with a lot of Jeopardy gays recently for some reason. Not just on the floor. I've interacted with some other Jeopardy gays, just IRL.
Yeah, they're around.
And a lot of them got beef with you.
Me, Lewis? Oh, why? Because of iconography?
A lot of these Jeopardy gays have won the game.
Which I consider tacky. Yeah.
No one remembers them. In one of their words, no one remembers me because I didn't do a snap.
Oh, is that so? Maybe you should have thought of that as I sit here like Marlena Dietrich looking absolutely fresh on television.
And I did say, well, it is a TV show.
Yeah, right. Nothing was stopping you.
You just can't be a nerd.
I just want to say, by the way, some queens have gone on since and they've tried to do it. Baby, good try. In the words of Alex Trebek, sorry.
People have tried to snap.
Oh, they'll like do a little move or something. And it's just like, guys, I can't explain this rhythm. I'm, you know, I got it. Okay.
I also learned there's like a Jeopardy gay like Facebook group.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'm in
there. They're all in there. One of them in there is a traitor.
Are coming for me?
Come for you, yeah.
Wow. I would love for them to get started on tarnishing my legacy. It's flawless and platinum-like still. Thanks.
You'd think pop culture Jeopardy would be this, but I'm like, can we have some sort of competition where just all, like a quelling, like in The Hunger Games, where all the Jeopardy gays are back?
Yeah.
Jeopardy gay all-stars.
Right. I also sincerely want there to be a trivia show that just gets as niche as possible. Like, people know all sorts of insane things. That should be tested in some way. But anyway, I'm so glad this conversation about the Real Housewives of Atlanta turned into a Jeopardy conversation, as I planned. Anyway.
I mean, what do you want to talk about? Revenge porn more?
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't have a salon.com essay in me about that. Sorry.
All right, Lewis.
Yes, my keep it this week. So on the way back from Berlin, which was a wonderful time, truly a wonderful time. If you've not been to Berlin, it's a spectacular international city. The best thing about an international flight is you watch 10 movies. So I had never seen About Schmidt, which is, I think, the only Alexander Payne movie I'd not seen. Really good. Jack Nicholson, I think, a little, not quite dim-witted enough to play the character. The casting to me on that was a little strange. Kathy Bates is great. Hope Davis, what happened to her? She was great. But my keep it is to people who get into fights about the greatest movie series of all time, in particular my friend Andy Heron, who I know is listening right now, so I can say this.
Scream.
He will pick Scream bitch, you are fucking crazy if you think the best movie series of all time is anything but the Before trilogy. That is the best movie series of all time. I only had time to watch the first one, Before Sunrise, which I think is probably considered on a Metacritic scale the worst of the three, since Before Sunset, I think, is the one people like think is the best. And then the last one, Before Midnight, you know, they're married and a whole bunch of other problems they're dealing with are super interesting. These movies are just unbelievable. And to be honest, I don't understand how Julie Delpy has remained this underrated. She co-wrote two of the later movies. She is entrancing in this film as an immediately believable character. And Ethan Hawke is, of course, fabulous too. And I love how he kind of seduces her off the train at the beginning of the movie. It's a really great scene. But she also wrote other movies like 2 Days in New York and whatever. Like, awesome. Just like really great material. And I just, there's no movies like these, which really surprises me. Because, you know, you would think we would just get more movies about great conversations that are a movie length long. And there are a couple, like My Dinner with Andre from the early 80s. This is so much better than My Dinner with Andre, which is insistent upon its own intelligence. Whereas this, it's like two people who realize in their connection how much experience in their lives now matters even more because they get to share it with this person. I just think it is like a spiritually moving and rad. And like in my social life, I'm in it for these types of interactions of like meeting somebody and just like figuring it out, whether or not it's romantic, and just like solving it with like intense, interesting, interested conversations. And so I just can't imagine saying any other movie series is as good as this.
Okay, well, there are only three of them.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know, a trilogy is a little bit different than I feel like a series, you know?
Okay, sure.
It's very easy. It's very easy to do a trilogy, you know?
And you're saying there's less room for error. Like there wasn't a fourth or fifth one.
There's less room for error, okay? I love Scream, but I certainly wouldn't say it's Scream.
What would you say?
Because I've seen Scream 4.
Yeah, right.
Actually, no, Scream 5. Scream 4 is good.
Scream 5 is the worst. Is the worst. Scream 4, the ending makes no sense, but up until then, it's great.
Yeah, I would say it's Mission Impossible.
Oh, okay. But like, aren't there a couple of those that aren't that good? Like Mission Impossible 2, babe?
Only Mission Impossible 3.
Oh, which I haven't seen. Who's in that one?
Oh, wait, or 2. Whichever one John Woo did.
Yeah, I think that's 2, right?
Those 2, yeah.
Yeah, right. That like late 90s, yeah.
Otherwise, I think it's pretty flawless.
I will say.
Tom Cruise doesn't make mistakes.
True. And Vanessa Kirby is just, she's got that Rosamund Pike thing of like, oh, you looked at me and I realized I'm with the craziest single person who ever lived. Something's up with you.
Julie Delpy, you know what we kind of need? We need one of those like book club kind of movies, but for the French bitches. Juliet.
Yes.
Isabelle. Like.
Charlotte Rampling kind of French, people like that. Yeah.
Catherine's not invited.
Yeah. Wait, is this because of Indochine?
They probably just don't like her.
Oh, yeah. You never know. I mean, like with French actresses, I don't want to get too deep into the interviews. I feel like they'll say the wrong thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But no, let's get all the French ladies together for something.
That would be lovely. Yes, I concur. Le Livre Club or whatever. It's been ages since I took French. I'm so sorry, Madame Mercoli.
Le Pain au Chocolat Club.
Oh my God, did Chocolat suck? I cannot believe that is Juliette Binoche's only fucking Best Actress nomination.
Wow, you hate Chocolat?
Of all the things in the world to make her, a chocolatier is not what I wanted.
Okay. I mean, I think it's so sexy.
Maybe to Harvey, not to me.
The rabbit?
No, it has nothing to do with Mr. Jimmy Stewart.
All right. Well, that's our episode this week.
Oh my God. Thank you to Marseille Martin for being here. What a delight. I would have her back most weeks.
And G20 is very fun.
Yeah, totally fun. Exactly the movie that should be coming out this time of year, too. Like, gives you something good to see, and Viola is perturbed as fuck.
I know. In an interview, she was like, I can't do Oscar bait all the time.
Dang. We love to hear it. Yeah.
She wants a check.
Yeah. And Tonys don't pay the bills. You know what I'm saying?
They certainly do not. Otherwise, Whoopi Goldberg, she'd own a mansion.
Right. And as you know, she... What do we think? She's poor?
She lives at The View.
Okay. Oh, I see. She's just in the studio. Got it.
Yeah. All right. We will see you next week. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Bill McGrath. Our associate producer is Kennedy Hill. And our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James.
Our digital team is Delon Villanueva, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Jarek Centeno. Thank you to David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
Our head of production is Matt DeGroat, and Madeline Herringer is our head of programming. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
And as always, Keep It is filmed in front of a live studio audience.
I'm Nate Silver.
I'm Galen Druk.
And I'm Claire Malone.
We're back, this time with our friends at Crooked Media for a new show called
Still Counting.
Yeah. No,
numbers are hard, takes are easy.
And frankly, numbers have only gotten harder.
What does the data actually say? How do we reconcile that with the other things that we're seeing in American politics and around the world? And how do we use that data to understand or maybe even dare to predict the future of American politics?
New episodes every Wednesday starting September 9th. Subscribe to Still Counting on youtube.com/@stillcountingpodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.